tell me first of all, Colonel Mann, where you were born?
I was born at Claygate in Surrey. My mother was passing through. It was my grandmother's house.
Which year was that? 1907,
the 22nd of February, the same day as George Washington and the two Baden-Powells, but different year.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a clergyman. At that time, he was a curate at Aldershot, and he got thereafter various livings, finishing up in Kent when he died in 1948.
What was your education?
Being a clergyman, he had five children, and I was the eldest, and there was no money. I was brought up to look forward to going to Cambridge, which is where he was, at Emmanuel College. I was reasonably bright. Rugby was his school. Rugby wouldn't accept me. They said had that my father been killed in the First World War, when he was a chaplain, I'd have got in for nothing. But as he wasn't killed, the fees remained the same for him and everybody else, however impecunious. So I was sent to, first of all, to a preparatory school at Wootton Court between Canterbury and Dover. From there I got a scholarship, a small one, to Dover College, the headmaster. My father had been the chaplain there once, and he had a bit of a pull. And from there, instead of going to Cambridge or Oxford, I was told that unless I got a scholarship, I wouldn't be able to go anywhere. I tried for a scholarship at both places because I was in the sixth form, not reasonably bright at exams, but I didn't make it. And so I was then forced to look around to see what I could do which wouldn't cost my father any money. And it seemed to me the best thing to do was to join up in the army as a private, which as a Y cadet they called it in those days. A little unusual, but people were doing it. And I joined up at the Buffs in Canterbury. I rose to the rank of sergeant. I left the Buffs in 1928. The regimental sergeant major said he'd be proud to salute me when he met me with my pips, which was rather nice. I went to Sandhurst, where I was a senior under officer of 5 Company, and the senior under officer of 4 Company was John Hunt, Lord Hunt of Everest fame. I passed out second, he passed out first. And I was approached by Captain Paul, as he then was, in the Middlesex Regiment. They weren't supposed to approach us, the instructors, but they did. And he said, would you like to come to my regiment, the Middlesex Regiment? I'd always rather thought a lot of the Middlesex Regiment. I'd seen that wonderful picture of Mons in 1927 or thereabouts. And the Middlesex fired the first shot of the infantry at the Battle of Mons. And so I said, yes, I'd very much like to come to your regiment. And I was commissioned into the Middlesex Regiment in January 1930.
Now, can we jump ahead to the outbreak of the Korean crisis in 1950? And can you tell me what you were doing in the summer of 1950?
Well, I'll go back, if I may, a little bit. I came back from Germany in 1949 at my own request. I was able to do that. I'd been out there, well, ever since D plus two, and my wife had joined me, and I'd really had Germany, like so many of us had, and I asked to come back to England, which meant that there was no job waiting for me. I was then a substantive lieutenant colonel, and I'd been on the staff out in Germany at the end. I was posted in August to Northern Command, and I hadn't been there very long before I got an order to take over command of the 1st Battalion of my regiment, who were in Hong Kong. The CO, who was a great friend of mine, having fallen foul of the general, who was a bit of a fire eater. I arrived in Hong Kong by air in October and joined the 40th Division under General Jeff Evans, who had won several DSOs in the Burma campaign, and it was quite a fire eater, as I said just now. His division had come from all over, been assembled earlier in the year to oppose the anticipated Chinese invasion of Hong Kong, and having got out there, it was being licked into shape by him. my battalion had come straight from guard duties at Buckingham Palace, so needed a bit more shaping than possibly some of the others did, and that's possibly the reason why the commanding officer didn't find favour.
Was there much of an atmosphere of tension in Hong Kong at the time of the communist takeover of China?
Well, I wouldn't say tension, because we had a splendid general. We knew what we were doing. We were digging holes on the hills at night and resting part of the day. There was no let-up, it was a very strenuous time. And in my case, in order to get the sufficient number of officers when they came out to join this division, my predecessor had induced various people by fair means and foul to join him on the understanding that once they got settled in Hong Kong, they would return to England. So when I arrived, I found that the regimental sergeant major was very good at guard duties, but he wasn't very good by my standards in the battalion. Various majors came to me very quickly and said, I'd been promised to return home, etc. And so it was the difficulties of training the battalion were very much increased by this coming and going due to the arrangements of my predecessor. So I think the answer to your question is we were very busy in for those reasons and for the reasons of defending Hong Kong, settling down as a division. And I don't think you would say there's any worry with us much, but the people in Hong Kong Island, we were on the new territories. The people in the island, they weren't a very delightful lot, making money and retiring early, and they didn't think very much of soldiers. Perhaps they remembered the Hong Kong troubles in the last war. And they, I think, were pretty nervous all the time, but we weren't.
Which Hong Kong troubles did you have in mind?
Well, I was thinking in 1940 or 41, at the surrender of Hong Kong to the Japanese. My battalion was out there at the time. They were ordered to lay down their arms. And I had one or two officers and others in the battalion who had actually been prisoners of war in Japan and had returned with the battalion in 1949.
But how seriously did you take the possibility of a Chinese takeover?
Well, it wasn't... I don't think we took it terribly seriously. We were sent out because there was a chance that politicians thought that the Chinese might invade Hong Kong. But I really didn't... In the way in which you put the question, I don't think it really applied at all. We just got on with our job. I think the civilians, as I've said, were a bit concerned, but we soldiers weren't a bit. We knew what we were doing, and we were kept very busy doing it.
Did the army resent the civilian attitude towards them, or lack of an attitude?
Well, we didn't know. We were so busy in the new territories that to get down to Hong Kong was quite a difficult thing. I bought a bus. We put our badge on it in order to get the soldiers down, some of them, some at a time, to have a bit of a change of air. But there was a certain amount of feeling between us soldiers in the new territories and the people nicely ensconced on the island with everything they wanted around them. And there was, now and again, when you saw somebody from Hong Kong, from the headquarters, land forces they called themselves in Hong Kong, they were a bit shy coming to see us soldiers, and we used to look at them rather as though they were inferior beings, although we treated them with respect due to their rank. It was a very rather amusing, amusing experience.
What specifically do you think the civilians could have done for the army in Hong Kong?
Well, they could have done, the Scottish firms and others, the Scottish regiments, they were the King's Own Scottish Borderers and the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. They, I think, had a certain amount of trips on private yachts and things, not in a big way, but certainly at a weekend they'd be invited along, and the CO and others were invited along, but the rest of us, not being Scots and not having that link with these people, tended to be ignored. Perhaps I should say that when it came to the seven-a-side rugger, there was a competition every year, and the Hong Kong Rugger Club invariably won it. And we entered, and we had rather a good team, and we won it, and it infuriated them. They really were very, very annoyed to have been beaten by an army team, but we beat them fair and square. And when I went up to get the cup, they said they wouldn't allow it to go to new territories. It was too dangerous. And that probably answers your question. I can assure you it returned with me that evening.
Now, coming on to the Korea crisis, did you know anything about Korea or the situation?
Not a thing. I had some Korean stamps when I was a schoolboy, but apart from that, I didn't know the first thing about it.
So did the crisis itself take you by surprise?
Now, perhaps I should say now that you're talking about 36 years ago, and I'm going to give you answers the best of my ability. And so what I actually thought at the time, I've probably forgotten now. But the best of my recollection, we were well trained. We were well trained, and there was always a possibility that somebody might go to help the Americans out, particularly as we discovered that the Americans had been caught with their trousers down. They didn't know the first thing about the build-up to the invasion until it actually began, and they hadn't got sufficient troops to deal with them. And the two troops in Japan were there with promises of a university-free education if they went to Japan and guarded dumps and things. And so they were very far from being the kind of soldiers that any army would want to have for war purposes. There was therefore a distinct chance that we might go, but as I said, we were very busy, we were trained, and we just awaited developments.
I think you were telling me earlier that Attlee had said that you wouldn't be going.
Yes, well, that follows up from what I'm saying. Round about the Korean War began at the very end of June, I think I'm right in saying, and round about the early August, the end of July, when things were going very badly, we all knew that, for the Americans, and we used to follow with some interest what was said in Parliament, in our papers and so forth, and the Prime Minister, Mr. Clem Attlee, announced in the House of Commons that on no account would troops be sent to help the Americans from Hong Kong. But troops, I think he said at the same time that they were planning to send troops from Great Britain. They certainly did, of course, later, but I think at that time he said they were going to send somebody from Great Britain, but not from Hong Kong.
What was your own role in the battalion at the time?
Well, I was commanding the battalion. I went out to command, as I told you, I had been in previous October, and I'd been pulling my weight, getting the battalion to shape as a efficient unit.
Can you tell me how you received the news that you were going to Hong Kong?
Well, as I've said, getting to Hong Kong for a change of air was not something which everybody could do. It was too far. I did get a bus to try and convey some of the soldiers pretty regularly down there, so far as I was able, but lots of them, well, there were too many. But I did get hold of the brigadier and ask his permission to have a weekend in Hong Kong towards the end of August with the Hong Kong regiment, to whom my regiment was allied. We'd fought together in the First World War, in the Second World War in Hong Kong. And the brigadier agreed. We'd been out, as I said, digging holes, digging trenches on these hills and so on, and we were due for a bit of a change. But we had to leave behind in the barracks a certain number, but having decided upon that certain number, the rest of us made our way to Hong Kong. The officers had a party in the Hong Kong regiment mess, but by their arrangement, we had a swimming sports with the Hong Kong regiment, which was all the ranks took part in. And I think we went down on a Friday night or the Saturday morning, I can't remember. And this swimming sports was on the Saturday night. And I was about to get up to say thank you very much at the end of the swimming sports, which I think we only won one event. They were very good. And they won everything else, but it was a good occasion. I got photographs of it. And I was getting up at about 10 p.m. or thereabouts to say thank you very much. And just about that moment, a messenger came along with a piece of paper, which I opened, and it said, report to brigade headquarters tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. So I thought, oh, Lord, this is probably it. And I went back to 402 The Peak, where a very nice Hong Kong regiment retired colonel was putting me up with his family, and I arranged with him to get up at 3:30, and my driver, my Jeep driver, appeared by arrangement, and I left him about 4:30, We went back over the water, back to our barracks, and on to brigade headquarters by 9 o'clock, where the brigade major told me that my battalion, the Argylls had been told overnight, I think, but that my battalion and the Argylls would be leaving the following Friday, and then it was Sunday morning, we'd be leaving the following Friday for to Korea in HMS Unicorn. The Argylls will be going with us in HMS Ceylon, the Unicorn being an aircraft carrier, in the Ceylon a small cruiser. There was a great deal to do. First of all, my adjutant, I knew pretty well what he was doing, but I had no idea with whom and where, except it wasn't in the barracks. He and everybody else was in Hong Kong. I was the only one who had come back. So we couldn't do an awful lot the rest of that Sunday without the adjutant, but we did what we could. And we were told it was all highly secret. Next day, Monday, the press got hold of it, and from then onward, the press turned up in hordes from all over the place. And most of them have written books since, which probably many people have read. And on the following, I wasn't allowed to take with me any. My battalion, I should say, was more than half national service. We made history. I think I made history as the first commanding officer to take to war a battalion, which is more than 50% national service. We got recruited. We had to make up numbers from the other regiments, the Staffords, the KOSB and others. The Argylls were pretty well up to strength with regulars, but we weren't allowed to take any national service man under 19 years of age by order of Parliament. So that meant we had quite a number to make up with, reinforcements we needed. We were short of a company. We didn't have enough troops to go complete, so we went with three companies, not four, And there we are, and you can imagine the amount of work that had to be done. And of course, General Harding, as he then was, Sir John Harding, later the Field Marshal, who was commanding in chief Far East Forces, came up from Singapore and gave us a splendid pep talk: shoot straight and shoot to kill, and gave us a good send off. Mr. Malcolm MacDonald, who was the, I've forgotten what the commissioner, I think his name was, from the Far East, he came up and addressed us all on the Unicorn. The Argylls came away from the Ceylon onto the, joined us with the Unicorn for the address. Again, there are lots of pictures of it, all which I expect people have seen. And that evening, the two ships sailed. We had two wives had appeared, because the wives weren't allowed to have our wives out there, but two had come with permission under their own steam, and they arrived about that week, I think, and they went just in time to see their husbands sail away, so that was a bit tearful, but in other ways, of course, it was a good thing the wives were back in England. They hadn't come out originally with the division, and my wife was back in England. She was able to meet them once a month at our depot then in Mill Hill. And she and I kept a correspondence going, and I told her of troubles, husband's worries, and she told me of wives' worries, and between us, we like to think we smoothed things over quite a lot.
Can you remember what else Harding said, apart from shooting to kill?
Not without, as you see around you, there's a mass of literature. If I was to be allowed to browse in that, I might find, but the part that I remember was shoot straight and shoot to kill, because that was the essence of it. He's a very, very inspiring leader. I've met him. I knew him when he was a colonel way back in the last war, and we all admire him tremendously, and we still do.
Did you have to do anything yourself in the way of motivating the troops?
Well, I don't know perhaps you haven't been a soldier. But if you haven't been a soldier, you're asking that question. If you've been a soldier, you wouldn't expect me to say anything, because you're doing it all the time. You naturally had to put them in the picture. I naturally did that. But commanding officers all the time are motivating their troops. The whole object of the army is to be prepared for war. And you just say, we're off to A and so on, and A is this, that, and the other, and we're leaving on a certain date. I mean, that's all the motivation a good battalion needs.
But as far as the specific career situation was concerned?
Well, I told them what I knew, yes, but it wasn't an awful lot. I'd read my papers, and so had they, but it wasn't an awful lot. I think General Harding may have told us a little more, but it was precious, precious little. We merely knew that the communist North Koreans had invaded South Korea, that the Americans had been caught with their trousers down, and they were showing no signs of pulling them up. In fact, things were going from bad to worse. Casualties were very bad. Generals were fighting tanks themselves with bare hands, and all sorts of stories we were getting. And obviously, they were in a pretty bad way. And we were going to help them out. A certain amount of banter then and later on, which we thoroughly enjoyed, because hitherto the Americans have come in late and said we'd won the war. This time we came in late and were able to have some pretty good back chat at them, which we did. my troops particularly, when we met them.
Can you tell me about the equipment of an infantry battalion in those days, what you took with you?
Well, let me ring off for a moment and have a look at my notes. Well, now, I've just got my notes in front of me. We had three companies, headquarter company, four machine guns and six mortars, and no transport. That was to follow us later. I should say that I flew with an advance party from the Argylls, brigade headquarters, and my own battalion. The brigadier, the CEO of the Argylls, Leslie Nielsen and myself, we flew off on a Saturday morning in two aeroplanes produced by the Americans. We flew over the ships on our way to Korea. The Americans were very casual, and we left when they wanted to, not when they told us. We flew over these ships. We heard later that they manned the guns because they thought we were going to bomb them. And the countersign, the Americans had no idea what the countersign was, if they ever had known. And the whole thing was that we weren't impressed with the Americans then, and we were even less impressed as the war went on.
We'll say more about the Americans later as time goes on, but how did your unit get on the Unicorn? What were the reports that came to you about the voyage itself?
Well, on the my second in command, Rowley Gwynne, who's now a retired brigadier in Scotland, he arranged for a certain amount of shooting from the ship out to sea, and a certain amount of as much training of various kinds, fitness and so forth, as was possible. And of course, on an aircraft carrier, you can do quite a lot. There's quite a lot of space. The Argylls weren't so fortunate.
When you went across on the plane, did you just land at
Busan? No. We flew to an RAF base in Japan, and there, which was very pleasant and nice after Hong Kong, and a very attractive little Japanese girl with long black hair came to the room I was allotted and wanted to know whether she could get me a bath and this, that, and the other. It was rather pleasant to be civilized after the uncivilized conditions in which we lived amongst snakes and smells and the night soil from Hong Kong and all the rest in the new territories. I remember that very peaceful night we all had in the rooms allotted to us by the RAF before we flew again off next morning to Busan. That was on the Sunday morning we arrived in Busan, and that was the 27th of August, my sister's birthday, so I always remember it. And there we were met by a military attaché, I won't mention his name, and he had a face like a boot. He was one of us, and he seemed to have been imbued with the American idea that all was lost, and he pretty well told us to get in the aeroplanes and go back again, because everything was finished. But with this, he annoyed us intensely, and I've followed his career since. He had a rather unusual name, but I don't ever want to meet him again. We were most unimpressed with the first British officer we met. Then we went driven up to Taegu, which is about 60-odd miles as the crow flies from Busan, and there we met the American general and their staff officers. We were put into a schoolroom, and they were pretty well in the front line. Everybody had come back as fast as they could, and that was at any moment now they expected the North Koreans to start to continue their attack. The retreat had been the advance had been so fast, and the retreat had been even faster, that the North Koreans weren't in a position to do anything very much until they got themselves sorted out. But at any moment, it was expected that something would happen. Do you want me to go on?
Yes, please.
And we then went down again on the Tuesday to Busan, and on the quay there we saw this vast unicorn coming in. She came in battened down because the commanding officer, I think his name was Thompson, Captain Thompson, was expecting to be attacked. But whatever the commanding officer of the Ceylon thought, there was no question of hiding the Argylls because they were festooned in their kilts all over the ship. There was just no room for them. I don't know how they'd managed to fit in at all. And they were festooned all over the ship, making a hell of a row with bagpipes and God knows what, and which is rather amusing because the reception committee, Korean girls, quite a lot of them, and heaven knows how many press, I think best part of 100 press men, and a lot of Americans sitting, an American band making rather a noise, and a lot of Americans standing around saying, you've all come too late, it's no good, you're just wasting your time. And the bouquets, of course, all went to the Argyles. They didn't see any Middlesex on Unicorn. And they didn't look, when they did come out of the hatches or whatever they do come ashore, the gangplank, and they weren't very noticeable, just ordinary uniform. But these lovely, exciting Scotsmen, they got all the attention, and the press didn't miss that. And they suggested in their reports, which I've got extracts, that we were looking a bit unhappy that they got it all. But we weren't a bit unhappy. One always expects Scottish regiments to catch the eye for obvious reasons. But a little later on, the commanding officer of the Argyles, Leslie Nielsen, whom I knew very well and liked very much, he's now dead, he was unhappy about this because they were getting all the press and everything, and my chaps were getting nothing. And he and I had a talk about it, and in due course it got sorted out. But well, we never expect too much of the press. They always go for the headlines and the kilts and so forth.
Apart from the talk of the despondent talk that you came across in Pusan, what was your own impression of the place when you first got there?
Oh, a filthy hole. Absolutely filthy hole. It was a disease, crammed with refugees and people. And it was, well, I didn't see much of it then, but I did see it again later on. It was quite horrible. I mean, if somebody had said that there was a bubonic plague rife, I would have been a bit surprised. It was dirty, horrible, filthy, and full of people.
Did you come across any evidence of disease?
No. Well, I mean, no. We were only there a short while. We went back in our cars to Taegu that evening, and the trains were laid on to take the troops up to Taegu. And we all met up again on the next day, Wednesday evening. And the Argyles and the CEO and I, we tossed up as to who should go into a riverbed, a dried up riverbed, and who should go somewhere else, which they weren't very exciting places. And I won the toss and got the better of the two places. And there we stayed and sort of got ourselves sorted out for a day or two before we had orders to go along and take over from some American troops on a long riverbank. Which was not far from, 10 miles or so out of Taegu, and there stand by. It was a most extraordinary line because it was held by, there were two or three, oh, I don't know, perhaps do you want me to go on talking about the Americans?
Cause yes, please.
Well, they were so utterly awful. Utterly awful. We were amazed at them. I remember going reconnoitering this river line. And I found the way they protected it, or guarded it, as they called it, was they had telephone lines going from a central position, spread out like the fingers of your hand, to listening posts on the river. And every night, a chap walked along the line with a telephone and settled himself down on the river bank and sat there with his telephone. And then he telephoned back to his headquarters every so often. And in the morning, he came back with his telephone and left the lines out. And they had on a sort of, every now and again, on a hill, one tank. And as you approach these tanks, nobody ever saw you coming. They're all inside. The tops are open. They were sitting inside. And as you came there, you saw cigarette packets, tins, cans, and heaven knows what being chucked out. And you had to knock on the door virtually to say anybody at home. You knew somebody was there, but it ought to attract attention. Well, that pretty well tells you they were not a trained army. They may have had the equipment, but they were not a trained army. But by our standards, we were just amazed. They weren't the Americans who fought in the Second World War. And we discovered, as I said earlier, that most of them had been virtually bribed, to go to Japan to guard dumps with the promise of university places or something afterwards. And there they were, happily ensconced in Japan with the Japanese girls' names written all over their vehicles. They weren't, I don't think, they weren't the pride and joy, I'm sure, of America, and it certainly horrified us.